she was sure that we were going to die. But when we all crawled in, she did too. I remember the instruments on the panel. I was fascinated. I decided I had to fly, but I thought I couldn't be a pilot because I was a girl, so I decided to become a stewardess. When Margaret graduated from high school, she had a change of heart about becoming a stewardess because she didn't want to go through nurses training, which was required for flight attendants at the time. She went back to her original goal. She wanted to fly. In 1940, she started taking lessons at the local airfield and earned her license by the time she was 21, just in time for the Army Air Force to recruit her for the WASPs. "I was flabbergasted," she remembers. "What an opportunity. My father said, 'I didn't get to serve and I don't have any boys, so I guess you'll have to do it.'" After 6 months of rigorous training in a wide variety of military aircraft in Sweetwater, Texas, Margaret was sent to Wilmington, Delaware, to the 2nd Fairing Division, assigned to testing and transporting the planes used to train young men for combat flying. "I was a co-pilot on the bigger planes because I was only 5'5", and you had to be 5'6" to be a pilot. It was very exciting and very demanding. We worked 7 days a week, sun up to sun down, but only when the weather was good because some of the planes didn't have radios yet. We'd fly a plane to Kansas, for example, turn right around and come back for a few hours sleep before heading out again. She flew the PT-19, a single-engine, open-cockpit training plane, the AT-6, an advanced training plane, the C-45, a small passenger and light cargo plane, and as co-pilot on the B-24 and four-engine C-54, many of them right off the assembly line. At first, the male pilots didn't know what to think about this invasion of their territory. Somehow word got around that these were a bunch of rich women who were taking the safer domestic flying jobs, forcing more men into the line of fire overseas. The latter half of the rumor was true. But these were no privileged princesses of the air. They were crack pilots, and at $1,800 a year, they were underpaid and underappreciated. Their mission was often dangerous. Some of the WASPs piloted radio-controlled low-target planes. They sat in the cockpit while a mothership guided the target plane through a series of low-level maneuvers by radio control. If the radio signals failed, they were there to take the controls. Other WASPs towed targets for anti-aircraft batteries and airborne gunners to shoot at, often with live ammunition. More than once, a WASP pilot returned to the base with more bullet holes in her plane than in the target. Margaret, or Maggie as she was called then, had a harrowing experience ferrying a worn-out plane to the boneyard, a remote airfield where aircraft with too many hours on them were parked. She lost an engine and radioed her superiors with that information. She was told to get out, to parachute to safety. Maggie knew getting out of the cockpit was a difficult proposition. Besides, she was confident she could nurse the plane down. It was a tense but successful landing. Everyone was full of praise, except the commanding officer who had ordered her to bail out. He chewed her out for not following his orders. When a WASP died in the line of duty, there were no military honors, even though they were performing vital and dangerous military assignments. As civilians, they did have the option of resigning, but few did. In fact, more than 900 were still flying when the Army decided in December 1944 that it no longer needed their services. The combat ranks were full and the manufacturing of new military aircraft was dropping off. The WASPs were told to go home. Maggie couldn't believe what was happening to her. "Here I was, this farm girl with this new life, and it was so exciting. And now I'm going home knowing all of my girlfriends have married or moved away. During the war, I had more in common with the guys than the girls who were getting their hope chest ready." She was determined to keep flying. She decided to get her flight instructor's rating. "I thought, I have all this military experience. I'll start teaching." Well, I got my instructor's license, but who wanted to take flying lessons from a girl? No one. Instead, she took a desk job at the local airfield, worked on the line directing and fueling planes, and waited for her chance. If a flight instructor didn't show up, I'd give the lesson. Once I got them in my plane, I usually kept them. My method was different than the men. In the early days, it was a rough business. Men used a lot of swear words, and intimidated the students. My idea was to tell you what to do, and you do the best you can. It's sort of a mother's instinct. Maggie did have one final World War II experience before going full throttle into her civilian flying and teaching life. She was at her desk job in August 1945 when the local radio station called to say it appeared that Japan was about to surrender. The local newspaper was on strike and people weren't near their radios during the day, so the enterprising station had an idea. A news drop, so to speak. It hurriedly printed up thousands of leaflets with the news of the pending surrender and hired Margaret to drop them over Fort Wayne. "I got to fly right over Main Street," she says, "over the factories. I was flying real low, only about 100 feet, almost below some of the buildings." It must have been some sight in that Indiana community, a small plane piloted by a woman at treetop level, papering the town with the news that the war is over. That memorable flight was just the beginning of another life and another aviation career for Maggie. The following year, even though she hadn't paid much attention to her hope chest, she was married to a local banker, Morris Ringenberg, a veteran of the Combat Corps of Engineers in World War II. They settled into a comfortable life in Grayville, a small town in the middle of Amish country, just north of Fort Wayne. They raised a daughter and a son. They also had a compact. Whenever he wanted to go golfing, she didn't complain. Whenever she wanted to go flying, he didn't complain. She also changed from Maggie to Margaret, explaining, "I thought it was more dignified for a banker's wife," one of her few concessions to convention. In the mid-50s, she discovered a new dimension to her flying, the Powder Puff Derby, a cross-country air race for women pilots. For the next 20 years, she was a competitor in that derby, later named the Classic Air Race. She won it in 1988 and finished second 6 times. That was a warm-up for her big race. In 1994, Margaret Ringenberg, the former farm girl who fell in love with flying at the age of 7 and learned in the WASP she could hold her own against the best of the best, decided to join a race around the world. 24 days in a small twin-engine plane, a Cessna 340, more than 100 hours in the air. She was 72 years old at the time, the oldest entrant. Her daughter, Marcia, had grown up with her mother in the cockpit. "I just accepted it as normal. When I flew with her, I read comic books in the back. But later, when people began making a fuss over her, I thought, maybe this is a big deal." Then Marcia saw the plane her mother would pilot around the world. "My heart just dropped. I thought, how could she go around the globe in such a tiny plane?" Margaret remembers the consternation among her family members, including her 10-year-old granddaughters, getting everyone in her Sunday school class to pray for her. She wasn't worried. By then, she had more than 40,000 hours in the cockpit. A lot of sitting is her understated way of describing that estimable record. The round-the-world race went off without a hitch. She finished out of the money, but then she wasn't in it for the trophy. She has a room full of those already. Testimony to her place as one of the most skilled and experienced small plane pilots in the world today. When she flies out of the Fort Wayne airport, the flight controllers take an almost reverential tone when speaking with her. "Notice the difference?" she asked. "I think they talk different to a woman pilot." She's at the controls of her single-engine Cherokee, and we're going for a short ride over the prosperous Indiana countryside. In the cockpit, Margaret settles her matronly figure comfortably into the small seat, and her eyes run easily over the control panel. This is where she belongs. She crooks one hand behind the yoke, or the steering wheel, of the small plane, and guides it to 2,500 feet, and then lets me take over for a short lesson in the Margaret Ringenberg School of Flying. I try to keep the plane headed in a straight line and a level altitude as we look down on the large new homes and golf courses that have replaced the farmland where her father struggled to make a living while working in the nearby GE factory. Her instructions are specific but parenthetical. "Yes, I never thought I'd see so many houses here. You're drifting left a bit. Try to go back to a zero reading. Use a light touch. Good. Oh, look, there's the Smith Field where I soloed more than 50 years ago. Actually, it was almost 60 years ago, but as she looks down at the small airstrip, She says she can almost see herself taking off on that memorable day that changed her life. Her passion about flying is matched by her generous ways. A Fort Wayne friend remembers how she flew him to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota several times so he could be treated for cancer. She was upset that I even tried to pay her, he says. She's a family friend of former Vice President Dan Quayle and flew him around Indiana during his first campaign for the U.S. Senate. These days, she's come to appreciate her standing as a role model for young women. She's especially proud of the women pilots in the military. They're still trying to work up to full combat roles, of course, but the women of the WASPs were not even treated as veterans until an act of Congress changed that in 1979. It wasn't until 1984 that the surviving WASPs were awarded medals signifying their participation in the war effort. Margaret follows the place of women in the military, and she's convinced they could hold their own in combat flying of high-performance jet fighters. For her part, Margaret was so hurt by the abrupt way her service ended, as she put it, I came home and put all of my WASP stuff in the back of the closet. Then, she was asked to represent the WASPs in a Fort Wayne Memorial Day parade. It reawakened the old pride. Now she gives motivational speeches at the Air Force Academy and serves on a scholarship committee for low-income women academy cadets. It's a little late, of course, but she says, oh, how I would love to be a cadet at the Air Force Academy. Margaret also works with Indiana schools on giving youngsters direction in their lives. It's a stark contrast, the difference between her generation and this one. She says, a few months ago, I went with an eighth grade class to the airport. I showed them around the hangar and talked about flying. On the way back to the car, I thought, oh, why am I doing this? It takes so much time. Then on the car radio, I heard the news about that school shooting in Arkansas. I realized if I could just reach one child, it's worth it. Margaret puts it in perspective. Everything that happened in my life came from one phone call from the Army. I can't believe what an opportunity I had as a 21-year-old who loved to fly. I was from the country, but going into the service, I found I could keep up with others. That wide-eyed 7-year-old farm girl, who can still remember the control panel from her first airplane ride, did more than keep up. She was a seminal figure in taking women in aviation to places they had never been. At the age of 78, she was still at the controls. The World War II years will forever be testimony to America's collective and individual resistance to tyranny, its awesome and ingenious industrial machinery, and what may be its greatest strength, the common values of its richly varied population when faced with a common threat. However, any celebration of America's strengths and qualities during those years of courage and sacrifice will be tempered by the stains of racism that were pervasive in practice and in policy. As it was an era of great glory for America and its people, it was also indisputably a time of shame. One does not cancel out the other, but any accounting of the war years is incomplete without the stories of those who were serving their country while fighting to protect their individual rights and dignity. What they experienced would be shocking enough if it were simply the work of a few misguided bigots, but the most shameful acts of discrimination and oppression were officially sanctioned by the highest officials of the land. Black Americans were called Negroes, or colored in polite company and official documents, but the hateful epithet nigger was a common expression, even when referring to black Americans in uniform. They had few champions of racial equality outside their own ranks. Eleanor Roosevelt spoke up for them, but her husband, the president, the great champion of the common man, was mostly quiet on the subject. Japanese Americans were subjected to even greater discrimination during the war. Their fundamental rights were swept aside in a campaign organized by some of the most distinguished figures in public life. The relocation of Japanese American citizens from their homes and businesses on the West Coast was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in the name of military security. In a contemporary review of that decision, the current Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, concludes that civil liberties are not expected to have the same standing in wartime as they do in peacetime, but he does believe the courts in the future will review more carefully the government's arguments for curtailing fundamental rights. Past practices and court decisions aside, the most compelling arguments against the wartime racism and official acts canceling civil liberties can be found in the lives and attitudes of the people who were the victims of those shameful episodes. Johnny Holmes was born in Ohio in 1921, but his family moved to the Chicago area after a few years because, well, because there was an opportunity. An aunt was involved in the Al Capone bootlegging empire, and Johnny's father could get a job as a driver and delivery man. They settled in the suburbs, in Evanston, home of Northwestern University, and life was good. His father had steady work, and Johnny, one of the few black students in Evanston High School, has no memory of any early racial discrimination. At an early age, he did become enthralled with the military way of life. For a time, he even considered joining the French Foreign Legion. So, by the time the United States was attacked at Pearl Harbor, it had a ready volunteer in Johnny Holmes, even though the U.S. military was hardly friendly territory for black Americans. It's not that black Americans were not represented numerically. 1,200,000 were in uniform during the war, almost 10% of America's black population at the time. However, most were confined to the service areas of the military. They were ship stewards, or worked in the quartermaster corps, or served as drivers for transportation outfits. Only 10% saw combat. Those that did had distinguished records, but the myths remained. The military establishment was reluctant to acknowledge black Americans were fully capable of taking their place in the front of the ranks. Holmes was blissfully unaware of what awaited him. As he put it, "I went into the Army to become a man. I told my mama, I'm not going to let it break me, I'm going to let it make me." He began his military career at Fort Custer in Michigan, but it wasn't until he shipped out to Fort Knox, Kentucky, that he encountered real, bitter, racial hatred and segregation for the first time. All of the non-commissioned officers were white Southerners, as Holmes remembers it, and they made the trials of basic training all the more difficult for the all-black outfits. Among other indignities, Holmes is persuaded that Fort Knox dentists experimented on the black soldiers. He remembers being strapped into a dentist chair and getting his teeth drilled with no Novocaine. At the end of basic training, Holmes was sent on to Fort Claiborne, Louisiana, to begin his training as a tanker. By now, Holmes and the other black soldiers had weekend passes, but even though they wore the uniform of the United States Army, and even though they were prepared to give their lives in defense of their country and for the cause of freedom and against the fascist juggernaut rolling across Europe, the racial wounds at home deepened. Whenever they accidentally strayed into an all-white neighborhood, they were met with anger and derision. When a black soldier friend of Holmes was found dead on railroad tracks near an all-white neighborhood in Alexander, the other black soldiers were not fooled by the official story that he'd gotten drunk, stumbled onto the tracks, and had been run over by a train. They were sure he'd been beaten to death, and they were furious. They were by now combat-trained, and they were prepared to go to war against Alexander. They rounded up their tanks, machine guns, and grenades, but their commanding officer reasoned with them, and they backed off. It wasn't long, however, before there was another racial flare-up, this one at the PX. A black soldier was cheated at the cash register by a white clerk. When the soldier protested, racial slurs started flying, and again, the Louisiana base was at a racial flashpoint. Holmes recalls with pride that not long after that, the PX staff was integrated. If anything, life as a black soldier became even more intolerable when Johnny Holmes and his units transferred to Fort Hood, Texas, to begin the final phase of their preparation as an armored unit. Fort Hood was also home to a stockade full of German prisoners of war. It is one of the little-remembered curiosities of World War II that German and Italian prisoners were often shipped to remote places in the American West to await the end of the war with more comforts than they would have had at home. Johnny Holmes remembers, however. He remembers the German POWs were allowed to go to the PX when Holmes and his friends could not. He remembers white officers saying, "If you boys don't behave, we'll have those Germans guard you." What he remembers most of all was an incident involving his platoon lieutenant, a recent graduate of UCLA where he starred in three sports, His name was Jackie Robinson. One weekend, Holmes, Robinson, and some of their friends went to Temple, Texas on a weekend pass. They weren't in town long before Holmes felt a piercing pain in his chest. He didn't know it at the time, but it was pleurisy, an inflammation of the muscles that can be debilitating. He could barely walk. Lieutenant Robinson helped his young soldier on a bus headed back to the base, stretching him across the front row of bus seats. The white driver would have none of it, telling Robinson to get Holmes to the back of the bus and get there himself. As Holmes remembers it, Robinson said no, he would not move Holmes to the back of the bus, and he sure wasn't going there himself. They were arrested by MPs back of the base, in Holmes' memory. In many other accounts of his life, the Jackie Robinson incident involved a light-skinned black woman who was the wife of a fellow officer. When Robinson was told by the bus driver to stop talking to her and move back, Robinson refused and he was court-martialed. He was subsequently found not guilty, and he left the service not long after, suffering from bone chips in his ankle from his college playing days. Holmes and his fellow black tankers shipped out for Europe, the 761st Tank Battalion. They were quickly in the thick of battle in the final drive across Europe toward the heart of Germany. They were in combat 183 straight days, including the worst of the Battle of the Bulge, the ferocious fight through the winter of 1944-1945 in the forests of Belgium. They were praised by General Patton and the other commanders of the infantry units they were supporting, but they could not fully escape the racial insults, not even there. Holmes remembers coming back from battles, their tanks battered and bloodied by the loss of their comrades, and hearing white soldiers tell Belgian villagers, "Those niggers ain't up there. They're just bringing the tanks up for the white boys to use." In fact, Holmes and the others in the 761st were face-to-face with death every day. One of Holmes' chilling memories is running through the woods on attack when he spotted a German sniper. He opened fire, killing the sniper immediately, realizing then and now that if he had not seen him just by chance, Holmes would have been shot in the back as he ran past. There was a widespread belief that black soldiers weren't up to the job. Dale Wilson, a retired Army major and now a military historian, said, "The African American was fighting a war on two fronts. He was fighting racism at home, Jim Crow, segregation, and he was fighting for the opportunity to fight. Here's a guy who has to beg to get into combat." General George S. Patton became a hero to the black tankers when he appeared before the 761st. Holmes thought he was the most dashing thing you ever saw, standing on a half-track with those two pearl-handled pistols. Patton said something to the effect, "You guys are a credit to your race. You're here because I asked for the best. Now go out there and kick some kraut ass." Yet there is also evidence that Patton had his private doubts about the ability of blacks to perform as well as whites in the military. Doubts about the fighting ability of the black soldiers were not confined to the American side. Holmes remembers vividly a conversation with a German prisoner of war, a Nazi major who had been born in Chicago before returning to the motherland. The major, stunned when he saw Holmes, a black man in uniform, said, "What are you doing here? This is a white man's war." Holmes and his buddies thought otherwise. They thought it was America's war. The record of the 761st was exemplary. Those black soldiers earned 8 silver stars, 62 bronze stars, and 296 purple hearts. One of the veterans of the 761st said more than 50 years later, "When you get over there and the nation's in trouble, you ain't got no black and white. You only got America." A simple and profound declaration from a man who, before he went into combat, trained at bases in American communities where the water fountains and the bathroom said, "Whites only." Johnny Holmes' daughter, Anita Berlanga, a Chicago businesswoman, still finds it hard to believe what her father went through. What saddens her most is that racism probably kept him from pursuing a legal career or a career as an artist after the war. She says, "I learned from my father how ridiculously hypocritical this country is. They took good, honest men and treated them poorly before and after the war." In the rage of combat, Holmes often made a deal with God. Get me out of this, and I will be a better, decent person. God didn't have to worry about Johnny Holmes, but he might have spent a little more time with some of the people who were back in Chicago, far from the front lines. One of them was working at the Foot Brothers factory in Chicago when Holmes went looking for work, now a 25-year-old battle-scarred veteran, down to 98 pounds as a result of lingering problems from injuries suffered when he was hit by shrapnel from landmines. It was Johnny Holmes' first stop after getting out of uniform. As soon as he entered the Foot office, he remembers to this day the woman in charge of hiring looking up and saying, "What are you doing here? We don't hire niggers. Get out of here." Welcome home, Sergeant Holmes. Shortly, however, he heard about a company that maybe had openings for machinists. He went early the next morning, and he was startled to find a black personnel director at Doler Jarvis Corporation. Holmes had never seen a black man in a white-collar job. The personnel director said he didn't have anything at the moment, but Holmes should leave an application, and he'd get a call if anything opened up. Johnny didn't leave it to chance. He showed up early again the next morning, and again the morning after that. Politely refusing to accept the personnel man's assurance, he would call when a job developed. When it was clear that Holmes would do this until he got a job, the personnel man looked at Holmes, sighed, and said, "Okay, report here Monday morning." Holmes worked as a machinist until the factory closed in 1951. Then he went to work for the city of Chicago and a variety of jobs until his retirement in 1985. It was a good life, he says. He was treated well on the job. However, Johnny Holmes and his fellow black veterans were still living a lot of their days as second-class citizens. Holmes married a white woman during his days at Doler Jarvis, and they stayed married for 38 years until she died in 1985. It was not always easy being a racially mixed couple in Chicago. Johnny can remember many occasions when he sent his wife, Louise, into a restaurant to bring the food out to the car rather than risk the wrath of some bigot who wouldn't approve of their loving but black and white relationship. For all his combative ways, Johnny Holmes decided he wouldn't personally bow to the inherent frustration of discrimination. As he puts it today, "If I let all of the negatives intervene, I would never have achieved anything. I kept focused on what I wanted to do, which was to make money, provide for my family." Holmes, however, did support the civil rights movement through his church, and he recalls with pride meeting Dr. Martin Luther King and joining him in his Chicago marches. He also set out to advance his station in life his own way, as a real estate investor. His specialty was low-income rental apartments and buildings in black neighborhoods. At one time, he owned as many as 3 buildings divided up into rental units. It was as landlord and as a black man who had overcome so much on his own that he came to hate the welfare system that grew so fast in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. "It just killed ambition," said Holmes. "I had all of these tenants who in their late 20s had never worked a day in their life. They just waited around for that government check. No incentive." Holmes speaks of the welfare system in the same tone of voice that he uses to describe his son's cocaine problems. Disdain. He's plainly disgusted his son, who makes good wages working in the oil drilling business in Louisiana, gave in to drugs, leaving behind a child in Chicago. Holmes wants nothing to do with his son. He's no longer welcome in his home. What Holmes went through during the war and after strengthened his already tenacious character, and he sees no need to compromise his standards for anyone, even family members. Although Johnny Holmes' unit, the 761st Tank Unit, was not involved in the liberation of the notorious concentration camps at Buchenwald and Dachau, according to its own official records, it was in that area. There's been some confusion about that over the years, and it lingers to this day. The 761st did participate in freeing the 15,000 Jews interred in a branch of Mauthausen, another concentration camp in Austria. So the 761st soldiers did have first-hand knowledge of the depravity of the Third Reich's racial attitudes. As indefensible as America's attitude was toward blacks, Germany's ultimate solution was beyond belief. Who better to put all that in perspective than Johnny Holmes? So he's always willing, when asked by Jewish organizations or schools, to speak about the horrors that he saw in World War II. In his 70s, however, he may be mellowing some. He's much more inclined to help out at his church or take his Lincoln Town Car on long driving trips than to sit around and remember the bad old days, or speak of the two-front battle he was forced to fight, Germans in front of him, racial bigots at his back. Now he can say with pride and confidence, "I am proud of the way I live my life. I was a good soldier. I serve my country. It is my country, right or wrong. I'm still waiting to find out what God really wants me to do." None of us can ever contribute enough. It was a fine spring day in May 1998 at the Presidio in San Francisco. The former army post in a bucolic setting of conifers and manicured lawns, hard by the San Francisco Bay, when the Honorable Nao Takasugi rose to address the National Japanese American Historical Society. He was a familiar figure to those in attendance. A member of the California State Assembly, he'd also served as a city council member and mayor of his hometown of Oxnard, just north of Los Angeles on the California coast. His family had been there since 1903, well-established members of the Nikkei, the name used to describe Japanese Americans as an ethnic group. When Takasugi's grandfather first arrived from Japan, he was unable to apply for citizenship because of his Asian ancestry. But he thrived by opening a small store, the Ashai Market, a popular store renowned for its seafood. He personified the American immigrant experience as thoroughly as the Irish Americans of Boston, or the East Europeans of New York's Lower East Side, or the Scandinavian farmers of Wisconsin and Minnesota. It was his grandson, now, who was at the Presidio at the age of 76, a testimony to the achievements of the Nikkei in America. By then, Now was an elder statesman in California's ever-growing Asian-American community. As always, he was proud of his ancestry. He was a Nisei, as the second-generation Japanese-Americans were called. But foremost, he was in his heart, his mind, and by virtue of his birth, an American citizen. In his remarks at the Presidio, he reflected on his long life in California, paying tribute to his family and their culture. Referring to his office in the California legislature, he said, "Upon my return to Sacramento on Monday, I will again take my place in the very legislative chamber that 56 years ago voted, with but one dissenting vote, to endorse the issuance of Executive Order 9066. Executive Order 9066. One of the most shameful documents in American history. It was signed by President Franklin Roosevelt on February 19, 1942, to begin the forced internment of 120,000 residents of Japanese ancestry, 77,000 of them American citizens. There were no hearings, no appeals. Executive Order 9066 was the codification of racism. Moreover, it was defended at the time by major figures in American civil liberties, including Walter Lippmann and Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Some didn't attempt to justify the relocation for security reasons. A California organization of white farmers, the Grower Shipper Vegetable Association, stated back then in the Saturday Evening Post, "We've been charged with wanting to get rid of the Japs for selfish reasons. We might as well be honest. We do. It's a question of whether the white man lives on the Pacific Coast or the brown man. They came into this valley to work, and they stayed to take over." Italian and German aliens living in California coastal areas were ordered to move in early 1942, but by June of that year, that order had been rescinded, and there was no major relocation for those groups. Italian and German immigrants were picked up and questioned closely. They may have had some uncomfortable moments during the war, but they retained all of their rights. Not so for the Japanese Americans. Now, Takasugi was a junior studying business at UCLA when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Suddenly, because of his ancestry, he was subject to a strict curfew. He couldn't be out before 6 a.m. and after 6 p.m. He couldn't go 5 miles beyond his family home in Oxnard, which ruled out UCLA, more than 50 miles away. Then, in his neighborhood, came the posting of Executive Order 9066. Here I was, he says, a 19-year-old college student full of ambition and ideals. All of that just came crashing down. The Takasugi family, the parents, four daughters, and now, were told to prepare whatever personal possessions they could carry in their two hands and report to the railroad station in nearby Ventura. An old family friend, a Mexican-American named Ignacio Carmona, went to Nao's father and offered to take care of the market while they were away. Nao recalls his father handing him the key, shaking his hand, and saying, "Whatever you make is yours." The Takasugi family was driven to the railroad station by another friend, the branch manager of the Bank of America. Nao remembers this man saying, "I can't believe I'm being asked to do this." The railroad station was bristling with armed guards. The train was a collection of ancient passenger cars with the blinds drawn. The Takasugi family, just days before, a respected and productive family of American citizens, boarded for an unknown destination, their most fundamental rights stripped in the name of fear. It was a world turned upside down for these law-abiding, productive, and respectable families. Now, more than a half a century later, Nao Takasugi recites from a journal of memory. "The relocation centers were not yet ready, so we were taken to the Tulare County Fairgrounds in Central California. Our entire family was housed in a converted horse stable. We shared one stall. There were 15,000 people in the temporary assembly center. They were there for 3 months. The people running the camp organized schools, and teachers were brought in from the outside. Nao says, I was a teacher's aide in the high school, teaching business and Spanish, my subjects in college. Typical of the equanimity that served him so well during his long life, Nao praises the quality of the camp drinking water that originated in the nearby mountains. One of the nicest things I remember, he says, it was excellent water. After their extended stay in Tulare, the Takasugi family was again loaded onto a train with the blinds drawn. They were not told their destination. That was very scary, Nao says. When the train stopped, they were in the middle of the Arizona desert, Gila River, a Navajo Indian reservation. Their relocation center was still under construction. It was a bleak and foreboding place, and it would be home for the Takasugi family and other men, women, and children of Japanese ancestry for the duration of the war. It was one of 10 camps established in remote locations, most of them in the West. Gila River, 45 miles southeast of Phoenix, had a population of more than 13,000, making it the fourth largest of the camps. It was operated from July 1942 until November 1945. Among those interned in Gila River were cousins of Nao, four brothers who all volunteered for the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the Army unit made up of Japanese Americans. One of his cousins, Leonard Takasugi, came to see his family before he shipped out after basic training. Nao says, "There was my American-born cousin, in his Army uniform, leaving to fight for his country, yet he had to wait at the barbed wire fence to get security clearance to visit his family." It was, for Nao, the ultimate irony of what Japanese Americans were experiencing during the war. They were good enough to defend their country, but they were always under a cloud of suspicion. That cousin, Leonard, was killed in action in Italy on April 5, 1945, Nao's birthday. In camp, Nao resumed his teaching job, for which he was paid $16 a month. Then, an unexpected opportunity. A representative from the American Friends Committee in Philadelphia, the Quakers, visited the camp to urge those who had been in college to apply for a security clearance so they could resume their studies. Nao was encouraged to apply to the business studies program at Temple University in Philadelphia. The Quakers would help with the cost, and they helped him with the application process. He was accepted for the February term in 1943 for the class of 1945. "Thank God for the American Friends," he says. "This was a shining light. In 4.5 years, they sent more than 4,000 young Niseis to school." During a long, lonely train trip that took him across parts of the Deep South, Nao saw for the first time the signs designating white and colored separate water fountains and public toilets. By then, of course, he had his own deeply personal understanding of discrimination. When Now arrived in Philadelphia, his first real trip out of California, he was worried about how he would be treated, but quickly realized that with a deep tan he'd acquired in the Arizona desert, most people mistook him for a Puerto Rican. He did so well at Temple, getting his B.S. in business in the spring of 1945, that he was accepted for graduate work at the prestigious Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. "I didn't even know what a famous school this was until later," he says. "I studied business and accounting, and once I got my master's degree, I pounded the streets of Philadelphia, applying to all the top accounting firms. They all said the same thing. You have excellent credentials, but we can't take a chance hiring you because of the war situation." Japan had surrendered the year before, but Americans remained deeply suspicious of anything Asian. By then, the families in the internment camps had been released, and Now's parents were back in Oxnard, where they resumed operating their market. They needed Now's help. "Being the only son," he said, "I had no choice." Besides, once back in California, he was relieved to discover his old neighbors had no lingering animosity. The family friend, Ignacio Carmona, had operated the store as the Los Hornigos Market, substituting chorizo, pan dulce, and menudo for the Asian products of the Takasugi reign. Carmona didn't disturb the locked storerooms, however, explaining to the Los Angeles Times later, "We knew that was their private property. We knew eventually they would take back the store." When that time came, Carmona simply said to the Takasugi family, "Welcome back. Thank you for letting us run the store." And he handed back the keys. Now was involved in every aspect of the family market. One day, he says, one of my Wharton classmates came to visit and found me behind the meat counter. He said, "You've got a degree from Wharton." I said to him, "MBA, Master of Butchering Arts." Under Now's stewardship, the market was flourishing. He wanted to expand, and he thought a new sign would help. However, the city denied the request. When Now complained to a city councilman, he was told there was an opening on the city planning commission. Would he like to serve? Now says, "I thought they needed a businessman's perspective. That was the beginning of my civic career." He had found his calling. He ran for the city council and was elected to 2 terms. Halfway through the second, the mayor's job opened, and Now had 3 good offers for the family market. He decided to sell and go for the top job at City Hall. "I was a little sad," he says, "because the market had been in the family since 1907, but selling the store freed me up to do a good job as full-time mayor." Now Takasugi was Mr. Mayor in Oxnard for 10 years. He had an important ally in the Mexican-American neighborhood called La Colonia. His old friend, Ignacio Carmona, was a community leader, and he stayed in close touch with the mayor's office. Carmona said of Takasugi, "He always made it a point to represent the Mexican community, and he speaks good Spanish." Takasugi kept his end of the bargain. He improved lighting, the roads, and police protection in La Colonia. In the rest of Oxnard, which had been called the doormat of Ventura County, he was successful in encouraging additional businesses, including a shopping center and an auto mall. By 1992, Takasugi was ready to move up the political ladder. He ran for the powerful California Assembly, the state legislature, as a Republican from a district where there were few Asian Americans, and he won easily. He was the first Asian American in the California Assembly in a dozen years. Takasugi was 70 when he arrived in Sacramento, an age when most men are retired. But he quickly established a reputation as an energetic and pragmatic lawmaker. One of his first acts was to challenge the established way of doing business by proposing the legislators lose part of their salary and pay a fine if they didn't get the budget prepared on time. His party boss, Governor Pete Wilson, did not have Takasugi's support when Wilson supported the controversial statewide initiative to restrict the rights of immigrants. As Takasugi put it, "I am just one generation away from the immigrants coming to California, so I have to be very, very sensitive." In 1988, Congress passed an act calling for an official apology and reparations of $20,000 to each of the survivors of the Japanese internment camps. The congressional action came after a commission held 20 days of hearings with testimony from more than 700 witnesses who had lived through the ordeal of Executive Order 9066. It was a deeply troubling reminder of a time when, as the commission concluded, the broad historical causes that shaped these decisions were race, prejudice, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership. In signing the congressional action, President Reagan admitted the United States had committed a grave wrong. There were other wrongs to be corrected. While most Japanese Americans were sent to camps, many young Japanese American citizens were relocated to Japan against their will. Didn't they deserve an apology and reparations? In 1996, the California Assembly was debating whether to pass a resolution encouraging Janet Reno to pay the extra reparations. Republicans were largely against the idea. Then, on their side of the aisle, Takasugi took the floor, and all were quiet as he said he would support the resolution. He told his fellow legislators that the memories of his own internment will never be erased. He said, "They may fade, but they will never go away." The resolution passed, 62-0. In his speech at the Presidio, Takasugi reminded his audience America must never again fall prey to the temptation to count its citizens by color. It is a lesson, he said, that can be passed on to future generations. The World War II generation shares so many common values: duty, honor, country, personal responsibility, and the marriage vow, for better or for worse. It was the last generation in which, broadly speaking, marriage was a commitment and divorce was not an option. I can't remember one of my parents' friends who was divorced. In the communities where we lived, it was treated as a minor scandal. My crowd, which preceded the baby boomers, retained that attitude, but it did begin to unravel. At my 40th high school reunion, second marriages were not unusual, and there were a number of third marriages. There were divorces before and immediately after the war, of course, but the laws governing the dissolution of a marriage were much tougher, and society was not as tolerant as in later years. Of all the new marriages in 1940, one in six ended in divorce. By the late 1990s, that number was one in two. Although divorce has been a common fact of life in America since the 60s, World War II couples have not fully adjusted. They're still unsettled by its popularity, especially when it occurs in their own families. At reunions of various World War II outfits, almost all of the veterans show up with their first wives, or if they're with a new mate, it's only because the first one died. Those marriages, I believe, are more than a reflection of the expectations of society at the time the vows were exchanged. These relationships were forged when the world was a dangerous place and life was uncertain. Couples were forced to confront the profound emotions and passions that come with a reality of separation and the prospect of death. If their relationships could withstand the turmoil and strain of the war years, they should only get better after that. John and Peggy Asensio have been married since a month after Pearl Harbor. He was 23, she was 2 years younger. They've known each other even longer, since they were youngsters in Bensonhurst, New York. Peggy remembers, "When I was 11, I was on my porch reading. John threw a football to get my attention. I threw it back. That was it." Shortly after their marriage, John was heading for basic training at Camp Pickett, Virginia. He was trained as a medical technician and assigned to the 118th Combat Engineers, the men who went in with the first wave to clear the minefields, bust through any defensive barriers, start a network of roads and bridges for additional troops and supplies. It was vital and dangerous work. At home, Peggy was a teacher in the Brooklyn Roman Catholic Archdiocese Middle School system during the day and often volunteered at the Red Cross in the evening. She says, "I never went to sleep until I wrote John a letter. I wrote every single day. I wouldn't break the routine because I thought it would keep him safe. You bet I got to know the men in the post office." Peggy also followed the progress of John's outfit through the newspaper and kept an elaborate scrapbook of everything connected to his part in the war, including newspaper clippings and his draft notice. In the Pacific, John was on the move so much he didn't get his mail regularly. He saw action in five different campaigns over 23 months. His memories of Okinawa, one of the most ferocious battles of the Pacific War, still come to him in Technicolor. We were down on our bellies and I saw one guy, his arm flying through the air. It had been blown off. I jumped up and put a tourniquet on the stump and got him evacuated. I don't know whether he survived. John still breaks down when he recalls one face-to-face encounter. I was on a scouting mission, crawling, when I came face-to-face with a Japanese soldier. He looked at me and I looked at him. I fired first. He went down. It was a horrible, horrible experience. It is all the more important to John that he won the Bronze Star for saving lives, not taking them. On November 12, 1944, at Dulog, Leyte, the Japanese sent a fleet of kamikaze planes to attack U.S. ships anchored in the bay. There were hundreds of casualties. John and another volunteer were on the beach, where they loaded a small boat with medical supplies and rushed out to help the stricken ships and wounded sailors for the next 7 hours. His breaks from combat were rare, so when he arrived in New Guinea, there were 58 letters waiting for him, most of them from Peggy. He read them in the order they'd been written, and he remembers to this day that in one of them, he learned that his grandfather had died. When he left for basic training, his grandfather had assured him, "You'll come back, but I won't be here." And then he had kissed John goodbye. What John experienced was characteristic of the personal turmoil in the lives of the young people at the time. While the men were in strange and hostile places thousands of miles from home, relatives died, wives and sweethearts were left to fend for themselves, children were born and dear Johns were written. Sometimes it would be weeks or even months before the men would get the news, however disappointing, sad, or joyous. John's outfit was dispatched to Japan following the surrender. They were assigned to the port city of Kure, just southeast of Hiroshima. He was stunned by what he saw in the ruins of the first target of an atomic bomb. "Hiroshima," he says, "was the most horrible thing you ever saw. Just twisted steel, complete devastation." Asensio is firmly convinced the decision to drop the bomb was appropriate. Like most veterans of the Pacific, he believes the Japanese would not have given up, and there would have been an untold number of casualties during an invasion. One small moment during John's stay in Japan is a poignant reminder that wars are made from the top down and the people at the bottom, were it left to them, would likely find another way to settle whatever differences exist. John says he was under strict orders, no fraternization with the locals. But one day, he and a friend passed by the home of the postmaster of Kure. He invited them in for tea. The postmaster could speak English. You should have seen his garden. His little son took out a geography book and pointed to New York, because that's where we were from. We had the most delicious tea. Never had tea that delicious. We were going against fraternization orders. I still had my rifle, but they were so nice. Days before, the two nations represented by the four people at the party had been in a vicious war with each other. The Japanese family was living in the shadow of the wreckage of Hiroshima, the most destructive act of war ever. They were entertaining two young Americans, men who were lucky to have survived the deadly intentions of the Japanese as they fought their way across the Pacific. Now, they were enjoying each other's company and a pot of wonderful tea. "I finally got back to New York on December 30th, John remembers. "I missed Christmas, but I got a temporary discharge so I could spend New Year's at home. I rode the train into Brooklyn with a rifle over one shoulder and a souvenir samurai sword over the other. I looked so strange." When they were courting, John and Peggy had developed a special signal so they could always find each other in crowded places, like Coney Island. It was what John called his love whistle, a sweet, melodious whistle in four beats he used only when he wanted to get Peggy's attention. When John arrived at the bottom of the steps leading to her family home in Bensonhurst on December 30th, 1945, a great deal had changed in his life. But he remembered how to do the love whistle. "When Peggy heard it," he says, "she came running out and almost took my head off." Her memory. "I had just finished making a big welcome home sign, and I was talking to John's uncle when I heard the whistle. I just ran down the steps and hugged him. MGM couldn't improve on that for a love scene. And as corny as those black-and-white movies about love and marriage during the war years may seem now, they were a reflection of what was happening to couples across the country. Newly married couples didn't have an opportunity to adjust slowly to the complexities of suddenly sharing a life. And then they were separated, often for years. Husbands were living in an intensely male environment, trying to deal with the stresses and dangers of war, while young wives were left at home, staying with relatives or living alone in strange cities, working when they could or caring for a child conceived before the father shipped out and born while he was away. Still, John and Peggy Asensio were typical. When he came home, they simply resumed their life together. They loved each other. They wanted to have a family. They were faithful Catholics. They were true to the way they were raised,